historically low numbers, and we cannot continue to have this wall of death functioning.
An effort to ban commercial set netting in Cook Inlet. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, November 6th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, bringing the Olympic torch to the North Pole.
They just drove the boat up on the radar, right? So we were at 90 degrees north, and there was a big celebration in the bridge.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. A message to parents from the Alaska Department of Education. Learning to read is the basis for all future learning. Parents can help their children get off to a good start as readers. Read with your young children every day. Do lots of talking with your kids. Make up stories together. Play games with words like rhyming games. Encourage your kids to write and draw stories and ask your school how you can help your children become good readers. This message sponsored by the Alaska Department of Education.
A group of U.S. senators, including Alaska's Lisa Murkowski, are pressing to strip military commanders of the authority to decide how to handle accusations of rape within their units. Murkowski said at a press conference today that every general who has ever come to her office to discuss the problem says the same thing, that they have zero tolerance for sexual assault.
We've had our eyes wide open. Well, they've had their eyes wide open now for 20 years.
Murkowski says the Pentagon's time to address the problem has expired. The measure she supports would let military prosecutors decide which cases to pursue. A former Marine Corps officer who says she was assaulted in 2010 also spoke at the event. Iraq veteran Ariana Clay says when she reported the rape, her commanders blamed and humiliated her.
The humiliation of the retaliation was worse than the assault, because it was sanctioned from the same leaders I once would have risked my life for.
The senators who turned out to support the measure today ranged from New York Democrat Kirsten Gillibrand to Texas Republican Ted Cruz. Top Pentagon leaders have come out against the idea, saying it will leave commanders unable to crack down on sexual assault in their ranks. Between oil taxes, marijuana regulation, mining, and the minimum wage, there's a number of ballot issues that Alaskans will have to decide next summer. But a group of sport fishermen and guides is already looking toward 2016. They've introduced an initiative that would ban commercial set net operations in the state's urban areas, including Cook Inlet. APRN's Alexandra Gutierrez reports.
Joe Connors operates a charter outfit on the Kenai Peninsula, and his Big Sky Fish Camp has lots of amenities. There are cabins with names like the Hawaiian Hut and the Hacienda of Happy Jose. But the big attraction is obviously the fishing. If you go to Connor's website, you'll see photos of massive king salmon caught by proud clients. There's just one big snag with his operation. In recent years, he's had fewer kings to fish. With low returns, the state has had to put fishing limits on the stock.
You couldn't troll out off of the mouth of the Deep Creek or Anchor or Nanilchik. That was closed. In the river, they had us fishing with single hook, no bait, and restricted to the lower 10 miles of the river.
Now, Connors is heading up a new group called the Alaska Fisheries Conservation Alliance, and their goal is to shut down the commercial set net fishery in the area. While the set netters mostly target red salmon, they also take some kings. This year, they ended up with about 5,000 kings in their nets. Sport fishermen got a fraction of that. Connors thinks that the impact on the king run is too much, so the alliance is pushing an initiative that would ban all commercial set netting in urban regions. He says it's not an allocation issue, but a conservation one, and that the state has not been doing its job in preserving the king stock.
The Board of Fish and Game gets diluted by the need to continue the set net fishery because it's a way of life, you know, whatever. But the bottom line is everything indicates, all the indicators, we have historically low numbers, and we cannot continue to have this wall of death functioning.
Set netters in Bristol Bay, Kodiak, and along the Alaska Peninsula would not be targeted by the proposed ban, and neither would subsistence fisheries. And while the ban would apply to places like Fairbanks and Juneau, the Kenai Peninsula would see the greatest impact. There are 750 set net permits issued for the Cook Inlet region with an estimated value of $10 million. While the initiative has language giving a rationale for the ban, it doesn't say anything about what would happen to those permits. Connor says that the possibility of a buyback is something that could be worked out later.
There might be discussion to that effect. That's something that the public would have to decide if they want to have that discussion, the state also.
Connor says he wants that discussion to happen over the course of a few years, which is why his group isn't doing a major signature rush to get on the 2014 primary ballot. Connor says they also want to give the legislature some time to consider their proposal before it would actually go out to a vote.
You can't have an initiative process without allowing the legislature to consider all these options also. So by going through the initiative process, we're opening all of these other options. Whether the appropriate people step up and deal with it, we'll see.
The sport fishing lobby is a serious force in the state, and the Alaska Fisheries Conservation Alliance includes one of its most powerful players. Bob Penny, an Anchorage developer and major political funder, has already begun sending letters to legislators explaining the reason for this initiative. Earlier this year, a group he founded, the Kenai River Sport Fishing Association, ran a successful campaign to unseat one of the governor's appointees to the Board of Fish. The initiative to ban their user group caught many set netters by surprise. A spokesperson for the Kenai Peninsula Fishermen's Association, which represents many of the area's commercial fishermen, said they were looking at the proposal and will have a response in the next day or two. Soldotna Senator Peter Michicki was out of town on personal business Wednesday, but said he's going to, quote, continue to do what I need to do to protect all the fisheries in Cook Inlet. This initiative is the first effort in Alaska to ban a gear type via ballot. In 1995, an initiative to prioritize personal use over commercial fishing was introduced, but it did not come to a vote. In Juneau, I'm Alexandra Gutierrez.
A University of Alaska Fairbanks administrator has returned from a trip to the North Pole. As KYC's Dan Bross reports, the journey was sponsored by organizers of the Sochi Winter Olympics.
University of Alaska Fairbanks Vice Chancellor Pat Pitney is one of 11 Arctic Nation representatives who journeyed to the North Pole aboard a Russian icebreaker last month. Pitney, a 1984 gold medalist in shooting, was selected due to her current post as president of the University of the Arctic, a consortium of 160 northern research and education institutions. The mission of the polar trip was to bring the Olympic torch to the North Pole for the first time. And after a 90-hour voyage, Pitney says they arrived on target.
They just drove the boat up on the radar, right? So we were at 90 degrees north. And there was a big celebration in the bridge with the captain and, you know, everybody that was on the ship. It was just champagne toasts. And then they had to move to an area with harder ice where they actually parked the ship so people could get off.
Pitney says an Olympic torch relay started on board the icebreaker where she was one of the runners.
I took it from the bow of the ship to the helicopter pad down one level, so kind of around the full length of the ship. It's a big, huge ship.
The torch was ultimately carried down onto the ice where a cauldron was set up and lit and an elaborate light show was staged. The torch is on a journey that includes terrestrial running as well as exotic side trips to the North Pole, the bottom of Lake Baikal, the summit of Russia's highest peak, and even into space. Pitney says the Olympic flame was carefully carried inside a special case during the trip to the pole.
It's like a little birdcage almost with the flame in it, and to preserve it, because it's one flame that they get from Greece, and that flame stays lit through the entire torch run.
Pitney says each torch runner had an assistant to ensure their flame stayed lit in the cold weather, conditions she says felt like home.
So essentially 0 Fahrenheit to 5 above, very little wind. Fairbanks weather, a nice day actually in Fairbanks.
Pitney describes travel to the pole as pretty smooth with just a few shudders when the ship pushed through heavier ice. She likens the icebreaker ride to being on a cruise ship with luxury accommodations.
Saunas, swimming pool, basketball court, exercise room, you know, meals to die for. I mean, I had a stateroom with a front room with a couch and a TV and a desk and a bedroom, double bed, full bathroom. Definitely traveling in style. And to imagine that you can be in a stateroom like that and literally drive to the North Pole.
Pitney says the polar trip was exotic for her and most of the other nation's representatives, but in Russia, travel to the North Pole is more common, both for commercial shipping and tourism. She says the journey emphasized Arctic cooperation as much as celebration of the upcoming Winter Olympics.
You know, you always wonder, is this real or is this just a show? But it wasn't just, oh, let's do this because it looks cool. There was a general interest in bringing that message across.
Pitney brought home a souvenir from the Olympic trip to the North Pole, the torch she carried as part of the relay. She plans to display it on her office wall. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, celebrating 75 years for the Shrine of St. Therese in Juneau.
People of all denominations or no denominations felt comfortable coming to the shrine, and that's been the flavor ever since.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by ConocoPhillips. The easy oil is gone, and getting to the remaining oil will be a challenge that will require the state and the industry to work together. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. And by Alaska Premier Dental Group, providing full-service dental care for the entire family with three offices, two in Anchorage and one in Wasilla. Service information at smilealaska.com.
The Ketchikan Gateway Borough Assembly is moving forward with a lawsuit against the state of Alaska. It's an effort to overturn what some local officials say is an unfair mandate requiring municipalities to fund a minimum level for local schools. The borough says that's unfair because many communities don't have that same requirement. What will the legislature's response be if Ketchikan wins its argument? KRBD's Lila Carey has the story.
First, some background, and bear with me, please. I'll try to keep this short and as free from legal jargon as possible. The borough plans to sue the state because the state requires the borough to help fund local schools. Not everyone in Alaska has to do that, though, and the borough argues that isn't fair. There have been previous attempts to overturn that funding mandate, and they failed. But in a report to the Borough Assembly, attorney Robert Hicks writes that those earlier cases had serious flaws. All that, though, is something for lawyers to argue about, and they will. But there is one burning question. What happens if Ketchikan wins? Is it really likely that the Alaska legislature, after cutting the state budget several years in a row with more cuts expected, will give Ketchikan an extra $4 million or more each year for public schools? And how about those 34 other municipal school districts that also pay their mandatory local contribution? Senator Bert Stedman was in Ketchikan last month to talk to local Rotarians, and after his presentation, I asked him what he thought might happen.
If the legislature steps in and rewrites it, and or the judiciary branch concludes that something different should be underway than what's currently the way it's structured, the legislature, we don't know what the legislature would come out with. It may be worse than what we have now. You just never know.
Stedman says he's working with other state senators, and a hearing on the issue is likely during the upcoming legislative session. He admits the political process can be slow, though, and the lawsuit might be a speedier solution. Borough manager Dan Bockhorst, who's led the fight to end the mandatory local contribution, says it would be great if the legislature came up with a solution on its own.
The Ketchikan Gateway Borough, of course, has tried for 6 years to have a less adversarial solution than litigation, and that would certainly be preferable. What are the chances? I think when it becomes evident the strength of the borough's argument, I think the chances of a legislative solution will hopefully increase.
Both Stedman and State House Representative Peggy Wilson agree that the legislature will have to come up with something if Ketchikan wins its lawsuit. Wilson echoes Stedman's concern, though, that what that something might be is unknown.
That's a pretty big question mark.
Wilson says the unintended consequences of winning the lawsuit could mean, for example, less local control over schools. She wouldn't vote that way, but can't speak for other lawmakers. Wilson adds that if the state has to foot the whole bill for education, that will lead to cuts elsewhere.
There will be more money that's used for the general budget, and there won't be as much money left for the capital budget. So
So that means everybody's capital budget would be less.
Bockhorst, though, says the legislature is cutting its budget anyway, and that continuing trend is actually a reason to move forward with the challenge.
As the state faces more and more fiscal pressures, the potential that the state will push more and more of its burden for its responsibilities onto local governments exists.
Bockhorst argues that even an unknown, court-ordered legislative solution is better than what we have now.
Whatever solution comes out of this, in my opinion, is going to be much more fair and more palatable and easier on the students in terms of funding and easier on the taxpayers in Ketchikan than is the current circumstance.
Another potential and more immediate consequence of the lawsuit was raised by City of Ketchikan officials. They worry that some Alaska lawmakers will be less inclined to approve capital funding for Ketchikan's projects and that those lawmakers will confuse the city government with the borough. The City Council talked recently about officially distancing itself from the borough's lawsuit. In Ketchikan, I'm Layla Carey.
Scholars and culture bearers are gathering in Juneau this week for a clan conference focusing on Tlingit knowledge and traditions. It runs tonight through Sunday morning at the capital city's Centennial Hall. Coast Alaska's Ed Schoenfeld reports.
The event is called Sharing Our Knowledge. It includes dozens of workshops and presentations. Juneau's Peter Metcalf is one of the organizers.
There's both academic presentations as well as non-academics who might be Tlingit speakers or might be artists, you know, in other words, people who are not necessarily credentialed academically but have deep knowledge of the topic or subject and can speak knowledgeably about it.
Sessions include linguistics, archaeology, Alaska Native history, museum studies, indigenous law, and traditional ecological knowledge. The clan conference theme is Our Language is Our Way of Life.
Our Tlingit language is a dying language.
Sitka's Jerry Hope is the conference's executive director.
And it was a concern of one of the organizing committee members that a number of our elders are passing away, and we need to be able to talk to them while they are here.
The theme is also evident in sessions on building a Tlingit library, regional language programs, and a Tlingit spelling bee. Hope points to sessions on gathering Tlingit phrases to use with children and bringing Tlingit into the home.
As it turns out, I have a strong belief that language in the home is something that is often overlooked.
The conference charges a registration fee with a day pass option. Discounts are available for students and seniors. Metcalf says it's for more than just tribal members.
The best part about it, from my point of view, is that you can walk into or out of a workshop and you'll feel welcome and understand what's going on.
The clan conferences began about 20 years ago under the leadership of the late Andy Hope III. After a 10-year pause, they resumed in 2007. This is Ed Schoenfeld reporting from Juneau.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Northern Air Cargo. Since 1956, Alaskans have entrusted Northern Air Cargo to transport their freight. Thank you, Alaska, for the opportunity to serve you for decades to come. Join Alaska bars and restaurants from every corner of the state in taking a stand against secondhand smoke. The fact of the matter is, no Alaskan, employee, or customer should suffer the heart disease and lung cancer due to secondhand smoke. The benefits are undeniably positive for Alaskans and for the bottom line. Clean indoor air. It's good for health and it's great for business. For more information on smoke-free workplaces, visit alaskatca.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Tobacco Control Alliance.
An orphaned black bear cub who recently became famous in the virtual world is settling into her new home in the real world. Now, a bear habitat in Sitka is writing her next chapter. KCAW's Rachel Waldholtz visited her recently and has the story.
I'm at Sitka's Fortress of the Bear, following Les Kinnear into a dark shipping container.
Careful coming out. It's probably a little slippery.
Inside, light shines through just a few holes. It's dim and warm, and at the back is a metal mesh fence. Behind that fence is another wire enclosure, with a thick bed of straw and a dog crate in the corner. And poking her head out of the crate...
Hi, little girl!
...is Smokey the Bear, the 9-month-old bear cub who is the fortress's newest and youngest resident. Kinnear runs the Fortress of the Bear with his wife, Evie, He settles down in the straw, holding a bucket of apple bits and dog kibble. And this... is the sound of the bear cub eating out of his hand.
The fun part is teaching her to... that there's enough food for her now, that she does not have to panic and eat everything at once, because there will be food, and more food, and lots of it. So we come in here a couple times a day, 3-4 times a day, in fact, and sit in here and work with her.
Little Smokey is taking every bite as fast as he will hand it to her. She's the size of a spaniel with a thick coat that makes her look much bigger than her 25 pounds. Her face is all snout.
Yeah, if you shaved her, she'd look like a chihuahua. She has a lot of fur on her.
The cub was captured in Seward, where staff at the Spring Creek Correctional Center found her in the space used for smoking breaks, hence her name, which Kinnear says she'll be keeping.
And they say she was eating cigarette butts and candy wrappers off the floor before she was captured. Her mother had been dead several days, and they scheduled to kill her.
The bear cub was a minor internet sensation after an organization called Angels for Animals posted a photo of her on their Facebook page, along with contact information for the Alaska Department of Fish and Game. Angels for Animals says the post reached 300,000 people, and the Department of Fish and Game was inundated with messages begging them not to euthanize the cub. The Kinnears volunteered to take Smokey, and it's a big undertaking. Now that she's here for life. She can't be released back into the wild, and black bears can live up to 20 years in captivity, Kinnear says. This winter, the fortress will have to build a new, separate enclosure to house her. The existing two structures house 5 brown bears and wouldn't be safe or big enough. Kinnear expects to get a second black bear cub from Fish and Game soon to keep her company. For now, in her temporary digs, Smokey has her head entirely inside the bucket, finishing off the apple and kibble.
She's got her whole head in that can.
Yeah. Here you go, kid. Hey, that's good. Yeah, there you go. There you go. That's the last of it. Okay.
Reporting in Sitka, I'm Rachel Waldholz.
The Shrine of St. Therese in Juneau kicked off its year-long 75th anniversary celebration on Saturday. The shrine was originally built as a place to inspire devotion to God. At the time, there were no other spiritual retreat houses in Alaska. And throughout its 75-year life, the shrine has welcomed people of all beliefs. KTOO's Lisa Fu has the story.
As you drive out Glacier Highway from downtown Juneau, you eventually start winding along the coast with intermittent views of the Chilkat Mountains. Past Tea Harbor, you start driving up. Soon you descend through a hemlock forest. Turn left at mile 23 and find...
a lot of trees, streams. As you walk down, you see log structures. You see the ocean.
Thomas Fitterer was director of the Shrine of St. Therese for almost 25 years.
You see a causeway. On the other side of the causeway is an island, Shrine Island. So you walk over to Shrine Island and suddenly you see a church made out of rock.
Surrounding the church are the Stations of the Cross, each station depicting a scene of Christ's final hours on earth and the resurrection.
Then you look out and the ocean waves are hitting against the rock. So you have God in nature so prevalent there that you cannot help but be influenced. Whether you're a believer or an unbeliever, somehow or another, one is touched by the peace, by the gift of natural beauty, and by the Spirit.
From the beginning, everyone has felt welcomed at the shrine, even in the 1940s, Fitterer says, when religious groups tended to stay separate.
Back then, even, people of all denominations or no denominations felt comfortable coming to the shrine, and that's been the flavor ever since. And that's something that I would never want to see lost.
The shrine was built as a place to hold religious retreats, escape normal activities, and be with God through prayer and reflection. It's still a place to retreat, but in many different ways.
The good thing about the shrine is you can do everything from have a picnic on the beach, to fish, to rock climb, to rock find, to walk the labyrinth. It fulfills the needs of people in so many ways.
The shrine has always been seen as a place to escape this busy world full of distractions.
You've got your iPhones and you've got your tweets and you've got whatever else. A lot of people just get caught up into that pattern.
Over the years, visitors have told Fitterer about how much they enjoy being at the shrine. People have talked of experiencing miracles and feeling close to God, even when they didn't have one. Fitterer recalls one visitor who had traveled all over the world, but felt a special presence at the shrine.
She just could feel it. And she said, I have never seen and felt a more beautiful place on earth.
At the shrine, volunteer Sam Bertoni walks to the outdoor columbarium where the ashes of his mother and another 200 individuals are laid to rest.
Some people come and visit all the time. I know people that come up out here on a regular basis every week to put flowers or to communicate with their loved ones. Some folks come out here many times a week.
A semicircle of six black granite walls, each about 7 feet tall and 11 feet long, face the ocean.
And it's a fantastic view. You know, I can't afford beachfront in this life, but maybe in the next life.
The shrine offers church services during the summer and other holidays throughout the year. Bertoni recalls one Easter service.
There must have been 100 people, and there must have been 150 sea lions out here yelping because of the killer whales. And there was so much commotion, you couldn't even talk. It was like 100 dogs barking. It was really something.
Over the decades, the shrine has grown beyond the original structures of the chapel, lodge, caretaker's house, and the post office. It now offers 5 separate rental cabins, which are used regularly for day use, overnights, weekends, and longer stays. Caretakers Jack and Jeannie Jordan are in charge of the daily happenings at the shrine. Besides being used by the Catholic Diocese of Juneau, the units are rented out by many other groups.
We have other churches, the state of Alaska, the school district, the Coast Guard. Different businesses utilize it. We have yoga groups, women's retreats, and sewing groups, scrapbooking groups, and anniversary celebrations, birthday celebrations, family reunions.
It could be as simple as wanting a quiet place to walk around, or as complicated as pondering the meaning of life. Jordan says people in search of something often visit the shrine of St. Therese and find what they're looking for. In Juneau, I'm Lisa Fu.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. We had reports tonight from Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Layla Carey in Ketchikan, Ed Schoenfeld and Lisa Fu in Juneau, and Rachel Waldholtz in Sitka. APRN's Alexandra Gutierrez reported from Juneau and Liz Ruskin from Washington, D.C. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineers are Dave Waldron and Kristen Platt. Josh Edge is our web producer, and I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, an Alaskan company providing lifting and rigging products since 1983, on the web at arcticwirerope.com. The historic Anchorage Hotel, offering space for rehearsal dinners, engagement parties, business meetings, or social gatherings. A boutique hotel in the heart of downtown. historicanchoragehotel.com. And by Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, committed to safety, operating the 800-mile Trans-Alaska Pipeline for 35 years. The Kinnick Arm Bridge and Toll Authority is developing the Kinnick Arm Crossing to further develop the transportation system between Anchorage and the Mat-Su Borough. The bridge could create construction jobs, provide access to land for commercial, industrial, and residential development, and shorten the route to Alaska's interior and North Slope. There's more information on the Kinnick Arm Bridge at kinnickarmbridge.com. This message sponsored by the Kinnick Arm Bridge and Toll Authority. The Older Persons Action Group, publisher of Senior Voice, Alaska's only statewide newspaper for older Alaskans and their families, can be read online at seniorvoicealaska.com. This message sponsored by OPAG.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.